You're listening to the only hour that ever was or ever will be. You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm your host, William Cooper. Conquest of Space. There's a good chance that the rocket, folks, will be obsolete for space travel within 50 years. Some of us have been concentrating on the development of the rocket as the possible power plant for outer space propulsion. We fired a lot of them, and we've proved that they will work in outer space. We've also learned a lot about what's out there by using rockets, and probably we will take the first few faltering steps into space with rocket power plants. But recent discoveries indicate that the spaceship of the future may be powered by anti-gravity devices. These, instead of using brute force to overcome gravity, we'll use the force of gravity itself, much as an airplane uses the air to make it fly. Sir William Crookes, the English scientist who developed the cathode ray tube we now use for television, made extensive investigations of levitation phenomena, a field that once belonged to vaudeville magicians. Scientists, reasoning that if they believed his reports of weird green glows in vacuum tubes, they should also look into Crookes' levitation studies, have been making slow but steady progress. Others have been investigating the fields of gravitic isotopes, jet electron streams, and the mechanics of the electron shells of atoms. T. Townsend Brown, an American investigator, has gone even further than that. There are rumors that Brown has developed a real anti-gravity machine. There are many firms working on the problems of anti-gravity. The Glenn L. Martin Company, Bell Aircraft, General Electric, Sperry Rand Corporation, and others. Rumors have been circulating that scientists have built disc airfoils 2 feet in diameter, incorporating a variation of the simple two-plate electrical condenser, also known as a capacitor, which charged to a potential of 50,000 volts, has achieved a speed of 17 feet per second with a total energy output of 50 watts. A 3-foot diameter disc airfoil charged to 150 kilovolts turned out such an amazing performance that the whole thing was immediately classified. Flame jet generators, making use of the electrostatic charge discovered in rocket exhausts, have been developed which will supply charges up to 15 million volts. Imagine, if you will, what this condenser or capacitor would do if charged up to 15 million volts. Several important things have been discovered with regard to gravity propulsion. For one, the propulsive force doesn't act on only one part of the ship it is pushing. It acts on all parts within the gravity field created by the gravitic drive. And it probably is not limited to the speed of light. Gravity-powered vehicles have apparently changed direction, accelerated rapidly at very high G's, and stopped abruptly without any heavy stresses being experienced by the measuring devices aboard the vehicle and within the gravity propulsion field. Amazing? Yes. This control is done by changing the direction, intensity, and polarity of the charge on the condenser plates of the drive unit, a fairly simple task for scientists. Sounds absolutely incredible, doesn't it? But the information comes from reliable sources. We are licking the problems of gravity. Indications are that we are on the verge of tapping a brand new group of electrical waves which link electricity and gravity. Electronic engineers have taken the electrical coil and used it as a link between electricity and electromagnetism, thus giving us a science of electromagnetics, which in turn has given us such things as radio, television, radar, microwaves, and the like. Now, gravity researchers seem to think that the condenser will open up the science of electrogravitics. Soon, we may be able to eliminate gravity as a structural, dynamic, and medical problem. Although we will probably use rocket power to make our first explorations into space, the chances are now pretty good that this will not always be the case. In 50 years, we may travel to the moon, the planets, or even the stars propelled by the harnessed forces of gravity. Now, folks, if this seems fantastic, remember that the rocket and the idea of a trip to the moon was fantastic 20 years ago. 50 years ago, the idea of commercial air travel was utter, complete nonsense. With gravitic spaceships, we may travel to the moon in less than an hour, to the planets in less than a day, or to the stars themselves in a matter of months. We may be able to do it in absolute comfort without the problems of zero gravity or even high accelerations. The idea of the rocket becoming obsolete is not a happy idea, particularly when so much work has been done on rockets. But we have worked on rockets because we believed they were the only type of power plant capable of working in outer space. If a better method comes along, why shed tears? After all, our basic goal is to travel and explore in space, and it doesn't make much difference how we do it. And during all of the time of the development of rockets for space travel, perhaps a few privileged elite scientists have always been working behind closed doors to develop the secret propulsion, the key that unlocks gravity. New science, folks? Something you've never heard before? Well, for most people, it may sound like new science, and it may be something that some of you have never heard before. But this is an article entitled Conquest of Space, written by G. Harry Stein, who was the chief of the Navy Range Operations of White Sands Proving Grounds. And this was taken from the June 1957 issue of Mechanics Illustrated. Now, shortly after this article appeared, nothing was ever discussed or written about gravitic research again. All of this information was placed behind a very thick and all-encompassing veil of national security. Previous to this, many articles had been written and appeared regularly in the scientific publications of the late 40s and the 50s. And right now, I'm going to read you another one. This is entitled Spaceships That Conquer Gravity by Michael Gladick, from the July 1957 issue of Mechanics Illustrated. The spherical craft, squatting on a concrete strip, emitted a faint hum. A ghostly glow surrounded its shell. The strange craft rose and hovered momentarily while its landing gear retracted. Then the hum increased and the craft shot eastward and vanished beyond the horizon before the witnessing scientists could click their stopwatches. An incredible speed. Jet-powered missile? No. Made weightless and propelled by its anti-gravity engine, the round ship was a research vehicle able to travel at almost the speed of light, 600 million miles per hour. How soon will such a revolutionary craft take to the skies? Well, since 1953, the Canadian government's Project Magnet has been working on a gravity-defying vehicle powered by electromagnetic forces. At least 14 United States universities and other research centers are hard at work cracking the gravity barrier. Convair on the West Coast, Glenn L. Martin Aircraft Company of Baltimore, Maryland, Bell Aircraft Company of Buffalo, New York, and Sperry Gyroscope Company of Great Neck, New York, maintain teams of researchers and engineers prying into nature's most jealously guarded secret, gravity. Quote, "Aviation is on the threshold of amazing new concepts," unquote, said the late Lawrence D. Bell, level-headed builder of the Bell rocket research planes. Quote, "We are already working with nuclear fuels and equipment to cancel out gravity instead of fighting it," unquote. Even before the famous apple fell on Isaac Newton's head, men were trying to solve the gravity problem. But from the simple prehistoric lever to the most intricate modern machinery, the best we could do was to win a temporary victory. "What goes up must come down," said the biggest scientific brains, helpless before the mysterious gravity pull. Newton and other great physicists formulated the gravity laws, measured gravity pull, and passed their findings to posterity. But their gravity laws had several exceptions that bothered inquiring minds. You won't find those inquiring minds, by the way, folks, amongst the sheeple. Let's take the strange behavior of liquids, for example. Move your fingertips slowly toward the surface of water and watch the water jump up to hug your finger. Or put a soda straw into the water and see the water level inside creep above the outside level in defiance of the Earth's gravity pull. Now, to get an even more striking contradiction of the gravity laws, drape a towel over the edge of a basin half filled with water. And after a time, the water will climb up the towel and over the side, and pretty soon all of the water that was in the basin will be on the floor or in the towel. These and other strange anti-gravity tricks were considered freaks of molecular attraction, phenomena quite apart from gravity, until Albert Einstein came up with his theory of relativity. Einstein said that molecular attraction is really no different from the gravity pull of the planets and stars. He theorized that this attraction works on the same principle as electromagnetism. A molecule, a planet, or a star all have gravitational fields, just as magnets or electromagnets have their magnetic fields. To illustrate the similarity, Einstein said that a gravitational field would attract and bend light rays just as a magnetic field bends cathode rays in your TV picture tube. Dr. Stanley Deser and Richard Arnowitt of the Princeton Institute for Advanced Study have recently discovered new subnuclear particles of the atom. Now bombarded by powerful electromagnetic accelerators such as the cosmotron and betatron, atomic structure yielded strange particles which may be the answer to the gravitational field problem. Quote, "Until recently, gravitation could be only observed but not experimented on in a controlled fashion," unquote, Doctors Deser and Arnowitt wrote in their scientific paper. Quote, but the new particles of the atom, which have been linked with the gravitational field, can now be examined and worked with at will. Unquote. The new discovery means that before long we shall be able to switch gravity on and off, as we do electricity and electromagnetism. The next logical step is a master of engineering. Let's take, say, an ordinary flywheel suspended upon roller bearings and coupled with a powerful electric generator. One side of that wheel would be under fire of our degravitational apparatus. The particles responsible for the gravitational attraction would be neutralized, and a portion of the wheel would be made weightless. But once out of the anti-gravity field, the same part of the wheel would gain weight and be pulled down by Earth's gravity, thus giving us a powerful rotating motor. Another idea for an anti-gravity device comes from Dr. George Rideout, president of the Gravity Research Foundation of New Boston, New Hampshire. Quote, to make a gravity motor, said Dr. Rideout, we need a differential of gravity forces, and the way we can get it is through a gravity insulator or absorber, unquote. To see how this device might work, let's turn to gravity's twin brother, electromagnetism. You see, for years we've had trouble with watches that get magnetized. You made a phone call or tinkered with your car's generator, and presto magico, the delicate balance wheel of your watch, exposed to an electromagnetic field, became a little magnet. Now your watch is no longer a reliable timepiece. To protect the watch from magnetic influence, we put the inner works in a soft iron casing that absorbs the magnetic force and shields the balance wheel. In other words, within the soft iron casing, we have a space free from the outside magnetic pull. We, in effect, and in reality, have a differential of magnetic forces. You see how easy that is? A gravity absorber or shield would do the same for the anti-gravity spaceship. The shielded interior would be free from the Earth's gravity attraction. The inner structure, equipment, and crew would be weightless in relation to the Earth. Thus, we would have a differential of gravity forces, and our ship would take off instantly like a super balloon. For ease of calculation, suppose we take our G-ship to the equator, where the rotational speed of the Earth is about 1,000 miles per hour. Now, with our anti-gravity shield completely shut, the G-ship would be hurled into space just as a particle of mud shoots off a spinning tire. We would scoot along a more or less straight line unless we had some way of controlling direction and speed. The weightlessness in a G-ship could be easily controlled by letting some of the Earth's gravity force act upon the ship's interior. An arrangement of shutters like Venetian blinds could do the trick. To control our direction, we would need thrust. A rocket would limit us to the amount of fuel, so let's try something else. We could have an ion rocket proposed by Dr. Ernst Stallinger, or another similar rocket, nuclear rocket, in fact, where subatomic particles are accelerated by a powerful electromagnetic gun and ejected into space. We could also utilize electromagnetic repulsion. We know that two like magnetic poles repel each other, just as under certain conditions an electromagnetic field repels the so-called diamagnetic metals. Take a flat aluminum ring, put it over a strong electromagnet, and switch on the current. The disc will fly off the solenoid with quite a speed. Starting with this principle of diamagnetic repulsion, a group of Canadian scientists of Project Magnet proposes to harness the magnetic fields of the Earth and other celestial bodies for propulsion of the G-ship. The Earth's magnetic field is too weak to repel or propel a G-ship made of ordinary metal. However, folks, current studies in the nature of magnetism point to a possible solution. Scientists believe that the answer lies in the structure of atoms. By rearranging the atomic structure, we could greatly increase the diamagnet's properties of the G-ship and make it travel along the magnetic lines of force like the aluminum ring shooting off the solenoid. According to Einstein's theories, there is no end to the electromagnetic and gravitational fields of the planets and stars. Those fields intertwine in a most complex pattern, but they are ever present. And proper selection of the fields and the controlled exposure to their forces would let us navigate our G-ship in space as well as within the Earth's boundaries. And the use of electromagnetic propulsion would, of course, eliminate the problem of fuel. Now let's take a closer look at the G-ship. Its spherical shape is dictated by the internal pressurization necessary for high altitude and, of course, space travel. From the viewpoint of engineering, a sphere is ideal for coping with the pressure differential. Also, it gives the maximum volume for its dimensions. An interior artificial gravity ring would solve the problems of living in a weightless void. The anti-gravity shield would completely conceal the crew and passenger compartment. This, of course, would eliminate visual observation. However, even our present radar and TV would give the crew excellent electronic vision. Apart from the cabin, there would be an engine room for the anti-gravity motor and the auxiliary power to run the electronic apparatus. Since the ship would take off and land in the atmosphere, there would be two problems to overcome: the heat caused by air friction and the question of air drag of the spherical shape. To take the singe out of the friction heat, Canadian scientists headed by Wilbur B. Smith contemplate an ingenious electromagnetic device. Switched on before takeoff, the device would attract and hold fast a large portion of air around the ship. Now, this captured boundary cushion would move with the ship. Therefore, the air friction would take place at a distance from the ship's structure, and the heat would be dissipated before it could warm up the ship's anti-gravity shield. The mass of captive air would be shaped into the most advantageous aerodynamic form. A teardrop for moderate speeds, a sharp-ended spindle for supersonics, and a concave cup-like shape for aiding deceleration for landing. It's time to take our break, folks. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short pause. Well, now that we've gone through all of this, how to propel our G-ship, as it's called, even for space travel, the stores and provisions would be small. Once outside the Earth's atmosphere, folks, the G-ship would be capable of traveling at near the speed of light, roughly 600 million miles per hour. At that speed, a 322 million mile round trip to Venus would take about 30 minutes. Make no mistake about it, anti-gravity motors and G-ships are coming. Remember, a year before the Wright brothers took off at Kitty Hawk, some of our top scientists proved that a heavier-than-aircraft could not possibly fly. And in 1935, the British Air Ministry nixed Frank Whittle's jet engine as interesting, but not practical. But the best answer to the disbelievers is that some of these anti-gravity ideas are already on the drawing boards of the United States aircraft industry. With their brain power and technologically know-how, the engineers will soon send Newton's apple back up where it came from. Now again, folks, I'm going to remind you that this is an article entitled Spaceships That Conquer Gravity by Michael Gladick from the July 1957 Mechanics Illustrated. And I'm going to tell you something else. By 1957, they had not only perfected disc-shaped flying craft, that did things in the air that conventional aircraft could not even begin to duplicate, but they had been flying these craft since shortly after the end of World War II. Now, if you still think that it's impossible and that it's absolutely out of the realm of human accomplishment, I'm going to read to you now, Garden Shed Genius, Heads for the Stars, by Michael Shanahan, taken from the Sunday Express, London, England, on October the 23rd, 1988. They also had a television show documentary of this experiment, which I taped, and it worked exactly as this article says that it worked. Pay close attention. Open your ears. Throw away the sheeple factor and become a real people. Join us on the cutting edge. On the cutting edge. Day trips to Australia and weekend jaunts in the Milky Way could become a reality thanks to the brain power of a Scottish inventor. Sandy Kidd's discovery, which is set to revolutionize travel, is already sending shockwaves through the scientific establishment. One of Britain's top physicists described it mind-boggling. And that statement, of course, is putting it mildly. Mr. Kidd's work, researched in his garden shed, will make science fiction writers' dreams come true. Trips to Mars will take 34 hours, and the journey from London to Sydney will be reduced to a matter of minutes. The 51-year-old former apprentice toolmaker's development of a gyroscopic propulsion has stunned academics because it challenges Isaac Newton's law of motion. He has worked out that by setting gyroscopes at particular angles, a lifting force that defies gravity is produced. Mr. Kidd, who worked for 5 years on his brainchild at his Dundee home, is now moving to the heart of the space industry in California, where a massive investment program is already underway. Truthfully, folks, and this is not in the article, the only reason he's being moved to the heart of the space industry in California is where they can keep an eye on him and make sure that what he has discovered is not sold or given away to anyone else. Because they've known this secret for many, many years. As you've already heard, it was developed back in the 50s. Probably came from Nazi Germany's experiments on advanced technology during World War II. And we have lots of evidence to back that statement up. Dr. Harold Asbedin, senior visiting research fellow at Southampton University, has seen the results of early tests. Scientifically speaking, it is a bombshell, he says. I would not have believed this if I had not seen it with my own eyes. Quote, it will totally revolutionize the travel industry, taken to the ultimate. We will have planes without jet engines and helicopters without rotor blades, unquote. Mr. Kidd is being financed by an Australian research company, a spokesman said. Quote, we are on to something really big. The next stage is to power up Sandy's device in California with the prospect of building a full-scale vehicle at the end of the day, unquote. Money is no object, and we are determined that his work will get out. Well, folks, if that ever happens, I want to see the day. Because if that happens, it will rip apart the veil of secrecy that they've had around this technology for the last 45 to 50 years. And nobody is going to allow that to happen, because that's their ace in the hole to bring about the New World Order by presenting us with an artificial and completely false threat from some other species, from some other planet. And I think the only obstacle to that scenario right now is they have not been able to produce anything in a laboratory, as of yet, that looks like an extraterrestrial being and can think and speak and is convincing. But mark my words, they will. And when they do, none of us will be able to tell if that creature was manufactured in a laboratory or really did come from some distant star system. And that's the inherent danger in all of this. For you see, just the presence, just the reality, just convincing the people of the world that such a creature could exist and could travel from there to here constitutes a serious threat to our planet and to humanity. For if they are more technologically developed than we, and of course if they got here and found us first, they would be more technologically developed than we. It would mean that our governments would ask for great sacrifices of all of us, giving up our freedoms, giving up foods and supplies in order to manufacture a tremendous space program, wasteful, gigantic in scope, to protect us from this external threat from outer space. And of course, since none of us would have any means at our disposal to verify the reality or the fantasy of this threat, we would have no choice but to comply. And the first realization of this massive, gigantic movement to protect the Earth from this alien threat would be a one-world totalitarian socialist government. Mark my words, this is only one of the contingency plans of those who want to bring this about, and they have at their disposal the technology that has already been used for many, many years to implant in the subconscious mind of the men and women, the people of the world, that the threat is real. Even though there is no proof anywhere existing upon the face of this earth or anywhere else that extraterrestrial beings exist, much less are visiting this earth. Now, in case you are wondering why I was devoting time to this subject, now you know. How you know? I found a speech given by John Dewey in 1917 to the visiting Japanese imperial delegation at a dinner in New York City, and John Dewey said this was the first words out of his mouth, quote, "Someone remarked that the best way to unite all the nations on this globe would be an attack from some other planet. In the face of such an alien enemy, people would respond with a sense of their unity of interest and purpose." Unquote. Remember, he said that in 1917, which means this was not a new plan. 1917, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you understand the significance of what I'm telling you. In the 1960s, a book surfaced called The Report from Iron Mountain. I'm now going to read you some of what was contained in that book. Some of the admissions in The Report from Iron Mountain are staggering. I quote from the report, "Though not yet expressly put forth is the development of a long-range sequence of space research projects with largely unattainable goals. This kind of program offers several advantages lacking in the social welfare model. First, it is unlikely to phase itself out, regardless of the predictable surprises science has in store for us. The universe is too big. In the event some individual project unexpectedly succeeds, there would be no dearth of substitute problems. For example, if colonization of the moon proceeds on schedule, it could then become necessary to establish a beachhead on Mars or Jupiter, and so on. Second, it need be no more dependent on the general supply-demand economy than its military prototype. Third, it lends itself extraordinarily well to arbitrary control. Space research can be viewed as the nearest modern equivalent yet devised to the pyramid building and similar ritualistic enterprises of ancient societies. It is true that the scientific value of the space program, even of what has already been accomplished, is substantial on its own terms, but current programs are absurdly and obviously disproportionate in the relationship of the knowledge sought to the expenditures committed. All but a small fraction of the space budget, measured by the standards of comparable scientific objectives, must be charged de facto to the military economy. Future space research, projected as a war surrogate, would further reduce the scientific rationale of its budget to a minuscule percentage indeed. As a purely economic substitute for war, therefore, extension of the space program warrants serious consideration. In Section 3, we pointed out that certain disarmament models, which we called conservative, postulated extremely expensive and elaborate inspection systems. Would it be possible to extend and institutionalize such systems to the point where they might serve as economic surrogates for war spending? The organization of fail-safe inspection machinery could well be ritualized in a manner similar to that of established military processes. Inspection teams might be very like armies, and their technical equipment might be very like weapons. Inflating the inspection budget to military scale presents no difficulty. The appeal of this kind of scheme lies in the comparative ease of transition between two parallel systems. The elaborate inspection surrogate is fundamentally fallacious. However, although it might be economically useful as well as politically necessary, during the disarmament transition, it would fail as a substitute for the economic function of war for one simple reason. Peacekeeping inspection is part of a war system, not of a peace system. It implies the possibility of weapons, maintenance, or manufacture, which could not exist in a world at peace as here defined. Massive inspection also implies sanctions and thus war readiness. Now, there's some more here, folks. Credibility, in fact, lies at the heart of the problem of developing a political substitute for war. This is where the space race proposals, in many ways so well suited as economic substitutes for war, fall short. The most ambitious and unrealistic space project cannot of itself generate a believable external menace. It has been hotly argued that such a menace would offer the last best hope of peace, etc., by uniting mankind against the danger of destruction by creatures from other planets or from outer space. Experiments have been proposed to test the credibility of an out-of-our-world invasion threat. It is possible that a few of the more difficult-to-explain flying saucer incidents of recent years were in fact early experiments of this kind. Do you understand, folks, what I'm trying to get across to you? Now listen to this. If you wonder if there is no ozone layer, and if CFCs are not depleting the ozone layer, and if ozone is really caused by the interaction between ultraviolet light and oxygen molecules, then what is all this ozone stuff about? Well, listen to this. Also in the report for Iron Mountain, which was really entitled, The Probability and Possibility of Permanent Peace. Nevertheless, an effective political substitute for war would require alternate enemies, some of which might seem equally far-fetched in the context of the current war system. It may be, for instance, that gross pollution of the environment can eventually replace the possibility of mass destruction by nuclear weapons as the principal apparent threat to the survival of the species. Poisoning of the air and of the principal sources of food and water supply is already well advanced, and at first glance would seem promising in this respect. It constitutes a threat that can be dealt with only through social organization and political centralized power. But from present indications, it will be a generation to a generation and a half before environmental pollution, however severe, will be sufficiently menacing on a global scale to offer a possible basis for a solution. Are you listening out there? You see, all of these are scams, contingencies, to create a cry for centralized control, a one-world government in the guise of permanent peace. Permanent peace is a noble goal. one-world government that we're manipulated into, where the protection of the rights of individuals, specifically in the United States of America, the protection of those God-given rights under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, is not a noble idea. For we do not know the structure of this new world government. We do not know their true intentions. We know that they state their benevolent intent, but if they are truly benevolent, why do not they include us in their decision making? Why cannot we take a vote? Why aren't these problems presented to the human race as a whole so that we can all use our minds to come up with an answer? Why must the human race be enslaved in a one-world totalitarian socialist order that is coming? Ah, but you say, this technology must be extraterrestrial, for we have the testimony of many people who have seen these craft, and that is true. And they say we have many people who have seen these aliens, and that may or may not be true. Ladies and gentlemen, there's no way to prove it. There is no proof or evidence existing upon the face of this earth or anywhere else to prove, or disprove for that matter, the existence of extraterrestrial life, much less their visitation to this earth. Ah, but there are the abduction scenarios. People say they're being abducted by extraterrestrials. Well, if they are, where are the witnesses, ladies and gentlemen? Where are the people who have seen these extraterrestrials? Will they pass investigation lie detector tests, hours of interrogation? So far, none of them can. None of them. I believe that many of these so-called abductees believe that what they are telling us is the truth. I also know that for the last 50 years, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Office of Naval Intelligence, Army G2 Intelligence, the secret societies, the profession of psychology and psychiatry, the Neuropsychological Institute at UCLA, and many, many others, not just in this country but around the world, have been very busy developing brainwashing and mind control techniques using hypnosis, drugs, electronics, microwave transmissions used as a carrier beam, along which radio frequencies tuned to specific brainwave frequencies can be transmitted, can wipe out complete sections of memory in the brain and replace it with a whole new happening that in fact never happened at all. Now, I'm not trying to tell you that extraterrestrial life does not exist, but I am telling you this, ladies and gentlemen. If you are driving down the road and your engine quits, it is the utmost stupidity and folly to look to a star system 300 million light years away for the answer. The answers to our problems are right here in our laps. There is no reasonable way that anyone can convince me whatsoever that anyone from any other star system would come here to save us from ourselves. What would they do with us after that, ladies and gentlemen? Would they take us to their planet so we could ruin that planet also? And then, if we did that, who would come and save them? No one. This is escapism. It is irresponsibility. It is the sheeple factor in its most malicious form. And while I'm at it, so is the concept that it's okay to ignore what happens in this world and not vote and not take part and not head off the suffering and the death and the tremendous, terrible hardships that are coming because you're going to be raptured. Well, I want to see the look on your face, folks, when you are not raptured, because you will not be raptured. I do not speak for God or the Bible or any religion or any church or any preacher or any dogma, but I will guarantee you that you will not be raptured. Any more than benevolent space brothers will come down and lift up the New Agers who believe that that's how they are going to escape what is coming. Escapism is escapism is escapism is irresponsible actions on all of your parts. Those of you who believe in these fantasies will help to condemn us all. Now, you may not like what you heard tonight, but this show is not about popularity, ladies and gentlemen. This show is about truth. This show is about responsibility. This show is about the human race growing up, standing up together. No more deception, no more manipulating, no more lies, no more master races, no more bullshit, period. I hope you understand that. The priest of the mystery religion, of the God of fire, the sun, the light, Lucifer, are creating their vision of a world utopia in which all existing nation states are erased from the world. All existing religions are smashed and destroyed and scattered to the wind. And all of the sheeple are enslaved to serve their masters. The Hyksos, as Mr. Tom Valentine puts it. Send a $5 donation along with a self-addressed stamped number 10 envelope for all the articles and reports that were used in this broadcast except for the report from Iron Mountain. Good night, and God bless you all.